this talk will be very applied, even more applied than the first one. It really, you should ask questions, because it serves as an introduction to certain topics that we'll be discussing in workshop 4 about brain imaging. And so I guess that's the idea in mind. Peter asked me to give this this lecture. So what I was planning to do is sort of have a short overview of the field and what are the scientific problems and the existing techniques, and then I'll show you an application of this manifold or commute time idea on such data sets. So, and we'll look at eigenfunctions and see how we can interpret them. We'll see actually some interesting observation of those eigenfunctions. So the general goal of functional imaging, goes back to René Descartes, and it really is trying to map the function, okay? And so why bother? Well, it has, unfortunately, lots of very down-to-earth clinical applications. For instance, when you're doing neurosurgery, you'd like to minimize the impact of the surgery on neighboring regions. And it's quite clear that every region is going to be important for a certain task. And everyone's brain is quite different from every other person's brain. So you need to be able to map. This is called pre-surgical mapping, where, if you're going to remove something here, depending on the way you enter, you're going to damage neighboring regions. Okay, so this is quite critical. Most people, can I get a little bit of, I'll show lots of images, so if I can dim a little bit. Can you see in the back, or is that too dark?
We can turn off the light.
Yeah, I don't want people to fall asleep. Okay, so I'll stick with that. So this is a sort of a standard brain image that you may or may not be used to. This is what we call structural imaging, where you, in principle, if the contrast were to be adjusted, could see all the fine details about the folding of the cortex, the optic nerve, and the eyes, and even the nose in the front. But this is not what we're interested in. What we're interested in is the idea that different regions will contribute to different functions. An idea that actually goes back to two centuries ago almost, when Brodmann, by studying different regions of the brain, was able to see that the architecture of the cells were actually quite different. And he defined broad areas that are still used today. Okay, the so-called Brodmann areas associated, with language and many different functions. So today's technique to estimate and quantify function is often based on very indirect principles. For instance, position emission tomography or functional MRI are based on this sort of idea that as the neurons fire, they're going to need energy, and energy is provided by glucose. So by either tracking glucose or oxygen, which is going to be used during the transformation of glucose into energy, by tracking either oxygen that is supplied by the blood or glucose, one can get a handle of where in the brain the neurons are firing. Okay, the specific ideas about functional MRI is that as you present, for instance, a cognitive or a sensory stimulus, so for instance, you're driving late at night on the dark road, and there's a car coming in front of you with the headlights on, and then immediately your visual cortex will start to fire because there will be a huge response. And so as the neurons fire, you're burning glucose, and so the local concentration in oxygen is going to drop. Okay, there is immediately a sort of a systematic response of the system. A few seconds after that, the small vessels that supply oxygen to the visual cortex will dilate. The pressure is going to increase, and there will be an increase in oxygen, basically in oxygenated blood, okay? In fact, there's an overshoot, so the supply of oxygen increases beyond the baseline level. And it turns out that this is this increase, this overshoot here, that is being measured by functional MRI, okay? So it's a very indirect process, and you can see the time scales here. This is the instead of the stimulus, so this is really the beginning of the experiment, and we can start recording some effect, about 5 seconds, okay? So this is a completely different order of magnitude than the milliseconds it takes for the neurons to fire.
So the MRI machine doesn't know it's being used for functional MRI, right?
Does not know.
It's the same machine, right?
It's the same machine. It's a little different. It's basically the same machine. Their sort of pulse sequences are slightly different. So this is just to give you an order of magnitude of the time scale. Why is the signal detected? Well, it turns out that the fMRI signal is very sensitive to lots of artifacts. Motion, that's why you can do images of the heart beating. And also it's going to be sensitive to the fact that the hemoglobin molecule will have a slightly different response when it's carrying oxygen or as opposed to when it's not carrying oxygen. So the signal, the MRI signal, will be different at this time of point as opposed to at this time of point. So the idea is to be able to measure this very small increase in the signal or change in the signal as opposed to the baseline condition, okay? So all the experiments are going to be contrast-based, okay? So there is no stimulus, and then there is a stimulus, and you're trying to detect this change. Does that make sense? Okay, so since we're talking about mundane things, a few millimeters in resolution, so there's lots of neurons in there. Again, the time scale is several order of magnitude compared to the time that it takes for the neuron to fire. These are sort of old numbers. We can get sort of higher, larger number of voxels.
What's a voxel?
Okay, so yeah, thanks, sorry. Voxel, okay. So if you look, this image, as Peter was saying, is not on the paper, it's actually digitized. And each little element, a sample here, if you're looking at an image, is a picture element or pixel. And if you're looking at a three-dimensional data set, so obviously a brain goes in the other direction. So you have, this is a volume element, so it's a little cubic
pixel.
That's right, a cubic, a fat pixel. So how fat, it's typically fatter in the z direction, in this direction, typically 5 millimeters. Okay, so here is the prototype fMRI experiment. A subject is looking at a light. The light has to go on and off, otherwise once it's on, it does not create a response anymore. So it's on, it's off, it's flashing. And what you do is you record the signal, for instance, here in the visual cortex. And so the signal varies as a function of time. So these are the voxel, the fat pixel. And the idea is that as this goes on and off, the neurons will fire, not fire, and so on and so forth. So we should be able to pick up changes in the signal that are related to the stimulus.
It said on the previous slide, it said the inter-scan interval was 1 to 3 seconds.
Right, so how fast do we sample in time?
So the top.
So, if you're watching a movie, it's typically sampled at 30 images per second, for instance. If you have very bad video, you can go down to 15 images per second. Here, we're sampling an image every 1 to 3 seconds. We can go a little faster.
So sneaky can't possibly work?
Why would that be?
Acting in tenths of a second.
True, but
you're faster than the rest of us.
Right, So here, you see what we're measuring, we're not measuring the firing of the neurons, where if you were to measure that, you would definitely sample at 1,000 hertz or so. But Here we're measuring something that varies on the order of, you know, several seconds. Okay, so if you sample this thing, you know, it's a very smooth curve. If you sample this thing, you know, and you put, I don't know, about 10 samples here or 5 samples, you're roughly.
I have to believe this seems very important. So I read someplace that it takes an average driver a half a second to apply the brakes.
Sure.
Seeing, sure. I see a wall, it takes a half a second.
Right.
So that doesn't seem to be consistent.
No. Okay. So here's the idea. Here's the idea. It takes half a second for the driver to apply the brake. Okay. But so now let's assume I'm not measuring that response. I'm measuring the heat that the brake is going to experience as it's being applied, as it stops, okay? It takes a lot of time for the heat to be created.
Uh-huh.
We're measuring that. Or you're measuring the decrease in consumption of gasoline in the engine as you apply the brake. So you're not measuring the deceleration of the car, but how much gasoline is being input in the engine. So we're measuring a very indirect parameter that has a very slow variation as a function of time. So we can sample a set. So what are the questions? So the questions are typically that we would like to be able to look at the ringing, the folding here that define the cortex, and be able to label those regions with a certain activity. So the difficulties are everywhere. There are difficulties because this define is, you know, this is not the way we sample this object, this brain, is typically by overlaying a Cartesian grid, okay? And you can see, for instance, if you have two voxels that are nearby here on the Cartesian grid, they're actually very far away in terms of the functions because all the neurons will, you know, be connected on that cortical rhythm. So the question of proximity, spatial proximity, is really is an interesting and really fundamental question in terms of defining and talking about functions. So this is why there are some attempts today at doing the analysis not by comparing voxels, but really sort of unwarping the brain and really moving along the cortical surface and really trying to find that, you know, neighboring in the Cartesian space are not really necessarily neighbors in the real functional and physiological space, okay? So those are the first questions. Then as you start comparing patients and subjects, for instance, to be measure what Peter was talking about on Monday, for instance, effect of, degenerative disease or then you're asked to compare brains that have, you know, different foldings at different places. So there's lots of ongoing activity in can we warp someone's brain to another person's brain, you know. These are, again, fundamental questions of geometry and in fact, there are some of the world experts, both in image processing and just brain mapping next door. So. This is what I talked about. In terms of function, the challenges appear in the sense that what we're trying to measure are very subtle changes. Okay, so as the light goes on and off, we don't expect to see changes more than about 5%. On top of that, there is the fluctuation of the signal that is intrinsic. So, for instance, if you image a bucket of water, if you image a cadaver, you will see signal changes, okay? There's some sort of random drift that apparently even has sort of a fractal or multifractal structure according to some studies. There is a small number of voxel that is activated in a given experiment. Of course, there's no ground truth, okay? You cannot cut the brain open to see if this was activated really at that place. So there really is no gold standard for the analysis. And so you can ask yourself, well, yeah, well, bother. But people are, you know, using these techniques, and so there is a great demand to be able actually to make sense out of the data and help people tease apart and find the real activation map. So the sort of state of the art or what people are using most often is the idea that you can do a regression. So if you write down your input stimulus, so this is a time series for us to think about it as this boxcar time series as the light goes on, the lights goes off, and you're measuring the signal here, can you do a linear regression to explain changes in the signal as the input is changes as a function of time? There are sort of different version of the same idea where there is sort of a convolution to model that as a linear system. There are lots of issues with those techniques. The main one is that it doesn't really take into account that neighboring voxels are going to have, you know, share similar responses. The other one that is a much sort of simpler, too simple model to explain the data analysis. So people have tried to look at multivariate technique, tried to do a single value decomposition of the data set to be able to uncover eigenimages and eigentime series. And there are constraints here. Again, you know, why would the brain want sort of decompose its activation in orthogonal components?
What's the idea behind linear analysis at all? I mean, as you told us, if you turn on the light and keep it on, things die out.
True.
Right. So there's always no linearity.
That's right. No, it's. You know, you're preaching to the choir. So the other question is what are sort of the possible interpretation in terms of the components? So there are variation in terms of this decomposition in terms of components. This idea of independent component analysis that have also been tried. Which assume now statistical independence of the sources. So as if the brain were, you know, composed of hidden independent sources that would contribute to the signal. Okay. So I will take a completely different take on this exploration and this analysis of data set. And I will try to show you some of the experiments, some application of the technique that I described in the previous talk to the data set. Try to convince you that this is the right way to do things. So let's see. So here are some synthetic data. What we've done is we've taken, this is a very simple brain, and this is the region that is being activated. And what we do is we have, we extract a time series from a real fMRI data set, and so that we have the right noise structure, and we add on top of that a very simple signal. So we assume that the response will have roughly the same profile that I was showing you, that there's a little undershoot than an overshoot, so this difference between two exponentials. And so we add this signal, we add this to the real noise. And then we generate some synthetic data, and we see whether we can discover this region where there will be activation, and those places where there is really, so this is the type of signal that we have here. This is when we add the signal, we can have strong activation, weak activation in this region. And the goal is to be able to discover that there are two classes of signal and to see if we can identify this region. So this is what the sort of standard linear analysis would give you. And in this case, in principle, the linear analysis would actually be best because you can sort of, in terms of signal processing, if you know what the signal is here, you can just, you know, build a match filter and hit this time series with the corresponding signal here, and provided the noise is white, you can recover perfectly or up to a certain amount your signal. Turns out because the noise here actually has some correlation because it's taken from real data, there's a lot of overlap between the white activated time series and the background here. This is what we have if we do the embedding, and we can see that there's a very nice division between the structure here. So we've actually run some analysis and comparison, So once we have our new coordinates, we can do clustering and find the right way to cut the data set. Of course, here we know the labels, but when the algorithm is run, we don't know. And so we need to decide whether this was coming from the white disk or this is coming from the background. And so this is recovering the white disk for instance, a lot of a large amount of noise. And we see that these are what we call false activation. So this region, the brain was not working here, and here we're missing activation. Okay. So this is just to show you the terms as we go to real data set in a second, we'll find those problems again. And so we can try and quantify how well we do compared to sort of standard techniques. So this is by doing a linear regression with a perfect knowledge of the signal. Okay, so what we do is we just correlate the data set with exactly the response, and so this is the match filter idea, and we see if we can recover a high correlation will indicate that indeed there is some signal here. So these are sort of table. Typically, what happens is that we tend to have more false activation, but we don't, so we believe that there's activation in places where there really is no activation, but we're not missing activation, so we're sort of a little too optimistic. Let's look at a sort of real data set, because this is where things are going to be interesting. So this is a study, the data set was actually lent to us by Lonnie here, and the idea is that we're going to have two type of stimulus. So the subject is watching a light, and the light can be turned on, and then this is what we call one trial condition, or it can be turned on, off, and then on again. So this is two consecutive stimulus, you know, it's like someone flashing his headlight rapidly. So we expect for this two trial condition to have a stronger response, okay? Note that the time between the two stimuli is actually sufficiently large, so we can see almost linear addition of the response. And so this is the trials are mixed randomly, and what we're trying to do is to see whether we can detect the region of the brain where we see this response to this light, either for one flashing or two successive flashing. So what we've done is we've analyzed the data, and we've tried to use the second, third, and fourth eigenvector using the technique that I described this morning. So for numerical reason, we actually have to constrain our analysis to a subregion of the brain. This is the visual cortex, just because the matrices become too large. Okay? So that we need to be able to find the eigenfunctions of that matrix. So again, to summarize from this morning, each voxel here will be a node on the graph, and each node, the coordinates of the nodes, are the time samples. So you can think of replacing the time coordinate system by a new coordinate system. So we collapse time, and we reparametrize the coordinates of each voxel with new parametrization. Another way to think about it is that if the voxels are close in time, that means they experience, they activate in the same way. So we want to be able to measure similarity in time here and to sort of draw a map of this similarity using new coordinates. Does that make sense? So one node, one point, is a voxel, but I really think about it as a time series. So it is, as the experiment goes on, I collect data at any given point as a function of time. And as the experiment goes on, if this voxel is responding in a similar way to its neighbor, the time profile, the time series should be similar.
It's
exactly right. It's one node on the graph. Okay? Okay, so I'll get back to that actually in a second. Okay. So if we, again, just for visual rendition, we can look at the representation now in this new manner. So here we're using the first three eigenfunctions, and what we've done is we've colored after clustering in this new space each dot. So each dot again is going to be one voxel, or equivalently the time series that I measure at that voxel. And we've done the following exercise, which is to look at this both as a voxel to see where in the brain is this point, and also what does the time series at that point look like. Okay? And we're going to travel along the branches and effectively try to interpret this new representation. Does that make sense?
What are the circles around?
The circles are here to identify those time series that we will look at in the next forthcoming slides.
And the clustering is done by hand?
No. Don't do anything by hand. So it's done by, actually, this is a good question. The clustering is a little tricky here because of the geometric shape. But it's basically automated. So once we have the clustering, what we can do is we can see how well we can capture within each cluster. We can reconstruct the data set. So what we've done here, this is a way to actually estimate the number of eigenfunctions. So for instance, if I look at the green cluster here, which we believe will be not very interesting voxel, okay, sort of background activity of the brain, not related to the stimulus, we can see how many eigenfunctions it would take to reconstruct fully all the time series within that cluster. And it takes a lot. So this is the residual energy, the residual L2 error, if I were to reconstruct the data set with the eigenfunction. Okay? So this is sort of a slightly different idea here. What we do is we take the data set, instead of looking at the value of the eigenfunction on the data set, we project the data set, we take the inner product between the data set and the eigenfunction, and we can see how well we can recreate the data set. Obviously, if we use all the eigenfunction, we have zero error. What we see is that there are some clusters for which a few, a small number of eigenfunctions can capture a lot of the energy. And this is the way right now that we're estimating the number of eigenfunctions that would be needed to represent the data set for the analysis.
So what the horizontal axis is?
So the horizontal is the number of eigenfunctions that I use.
So that meant you had to compute 12 of them?
Yeah, we typically compute about 12 of them. Okay, so now let's go and do a different thing. So what we, and we'll come back to the clustering. What we can do is, since we know whether there was a strong or a weak signal, the one trial versus two trial condition, we can color code each time series, okay? And we can see that most of the blue sort of weaker signal occurs here. That doesn't mean that these are activated. They could, that just means that they correspond to time at which there was only a weak stimulus. But more interestingly, we'll see that this branch corresponds to time series that are activated, voxels that are activated. And we can see that the beginning corresponds to weak activation. As we'll see that as we move along this branch, we get to higher, stronger activation. So just to reassure ourselves, we've done the standard analysis, which corresponds to trying to find the best linear subspace that would capture the variance of our data, the principal component analysis or a single value decomposition. We can see that there really is no structure coming up, okay? Which means that standard linear technique will typically fail for this data set. This is a sort of a competing algorithm where we can build a graph and do almost the same idea, but now here, instead of using the diffusion idea, we're trying to measure geodesy, to measure proximity of points on the graph. Again, this is a technique that is, in a certain sense, similar. However, the data set is so noisy that if you're trying to measure the shortest distance as opposed to the commute time, you're lost. And in this case, really, we don't see any structure appearing. This, in a certain sense, shows you that the right distance for this type of data set is not the shortest distance, okay? Because point can be very close to one another, but they're just close because there's this random jittering, there's the noise. And so the really the good distance is commute time. So what do the eigen functions look like? We can actually look at them because if you think about the eigenfunction is sampled on the data set. And so the value that I have on those axes, okay, corresponds to a certain number. So each voxel can be color-coded according to the value of phi2, phi3, and phi4. So we can look at those eigenfunctions in terms of actual images on the data set. Is everyone understanding this? No?
Yes? The original eigenfunction.
So what we're doing, we have the data set, or the graph, and now we have those eigenfunctions that live on the data set. Okay? So for instance, let's look at the first non-trivial eigenfunction. Each point here will be a node in the graph, and when I found this eigenfunction, really what I compute is the value of that eigenfunction at that node. So nothing prevents me to color code my brain images in terms of the value of the eigenfunction. Okay? So,
but this is spatial, right?
Yeah,
so you're not showing the time, correct?
Time is gone. So I've replaced time by essentially spectral information, right? So I started with the data.
See, if I know this for each space guy, there's the corresponding time series.
That's right, yeah. So think about it another way. Each point here, you know, what we've done is we've replaced time by a frequency information, and what we're showing here is sort of, you can think about them as being sort of Fourier modes on your domain. Okay, so this would be the first eigenfunction. So what is interesting is that they are extremely localized, and most, you see the blue is zero, and the nodal regions where you go from, you know, positive to negative actually can be interpreted, and we'll see that. They are essentially finding the region of activation. So, what we'll do is we'll go back to those functions and see how we can interpret each eigenfunction. So, if you look at phi2, for instance, phi2 is really the function that makes it possible, for instance, to cut the red. So, if you just look at this, the green on one side and the two other branches on the other side. Phi 3 or phi 4 actually gives you a way to sort of get rid of the blue information, and phi 3 is really useful to separate the blue from the red. So what we've done now is we've looked at the time series, so the little circles here went back to the original representation in time and tried to understand what the branches are. So is this representation meaningful at all? So I should show both. So basically, I will look at two clusters. The two branches. There's the blue branch here, and the red branch. And the red branch. There are two groups of time series that I will look at. Those that are near the green blob here, and the one that are at the very tip. So the one that are very tip are here. The one that are closer to the green blob are here for the red branch, and the blue cluster is here. So this is zero. So that means there really is almost no response except for a big dip here in the signal. For the blue branch. For the red branch, we really have something that looks like activation, so it goes up and then goes back to zero. And as we move along the tip of the branch, we have much stronger activation. So this is a very good candidate for, you know, voxels that would be activated by the stimulus. So in a nutshell, this validates our understanding of the grouping of the voxels or the time series that is discovered by this technique. So we can go back inside the data set and color code the blue and the red. And the red are indeed in the visual cortex where we would expect them to be. The blue are, interestingly enough, most of the time at the boundary of the brain. And so what we've done is we've compared our analysis with what people use, which is the standard linear regression. So this is the linear regression, this is our analysis. So the red are the right place. And so when we went back and tried to understand what are the blue? And so what happened is that there's this big dip here at time 7, and our interpretation of the blue is that at time 7 the subject moved his head slightly, and so all of a sudden, instead of imaging inside the head, we're imaging, you know, in the air. And so the two drops dramatically. So this technique is actually quite useful because it automatically finds the artifact in the signal. That means we just should throw away all those voxels. Okay? It should be part
of
it.
Is that a fact or is that a hypothesis that he moved his head?
That's the hypothesis coming from a neurologist. That those voxels are just completely outside.
Can you reproduce that?
It's a good question. We should be able to do that. But it's, you see, whether it's the motion of the head or some other artifact, the signature of those time series is that they're all broadly dropping at this. So this is basically, the blue cluster is the class of signal that exhibit this behavior in time. How am I doing with time? Okay, excellent. So again, this analysis makes absolutely no hypothesis about, how is the signal created. This is not a linear model, but we get, activation patterns that are very consistent with that. Let's look at a different experiment. This is a periodic excitation using a checkerboard, so an image that is like a checkerboard and goes on and off. And so we have collected some data, and again here we're trying to analyze a region in the back of the brain expecting to see activation in the visual cortex. These are the eyes, this is the back of the brain. So if we feed the data set, so if we feed all those time series that have been extracted in this three-dimensional volume, here we have four consecutive slices, within each slice we have a time series, and we feed that to an SVD decomposition. This is what we find if we project on the first three eigenfunctions. The same thing happens if we're trying to walk on the data set and measure proximity by using the geodesic distance. And this is what happens if you use this idea of running the heat kernel or measuring commute time. And again, we've done the same exercise, which is first to sort of cut the branches automatically and so find this clustering, nice partition, and then visit each branch and understand where the data are coming from inside the brain and what is the temporal signature of those time series here. So we can see in terms of the number of eigenfunctions that blue and red need very few eigenfunctions to be reconstructed. So those branches probably are interesting for us. The red and the green are much less interesting. So again, if we look at the eigenvectors, if we look at actually why do phi2 and phi3, well, phi2 is really going to capture, this is the good coordinate to parametrize the red branch, okay? Phi3 is the good coordinate to parametrize the blue branch. So we can look at those eigenfunctions. Sorry. And again, miracle happens. So the call map is quite different here. I do apologize. Red is zero here, whereas here, sort of light blue is zero. This is a terrible choice. But what is interesting is where we have transitions. These places, the place where we have transition, where we transition from either small negative or positive to zero, are places of interest to our analysis. And again, we see that those eigenfunctions are extremely well localized. Something I didn't expect with my naive understanding of spectral geometry. I would expect something much more global, sort of oscillations on the data set. What we've done here is we've visited each cluster and overlaid here are the different points that we circled. And we can see on the red elongated cluster that was well represented by phi 2, that we have a periodic response that is indicative of the response to the periodic stimulus. The blue cluster is very interesting because it's oscillating extremely fast, which is almost the Nyquist frequency for this for the sampling. The green cluster is a lot harder to interpret. So what we've done is we've color-coded the voxel, okay, according to their origin, their new coordinates in the branches here. So red is definitely corresponding to sort of the visual cortex. And we believe that blue, that corresponds to this very fast oscillation, is probably caused by some physiological artifacts. So for instance, a pulsating vein, where the blood flow, which is really what is the source of the fMRI signal, is rapidly going on and off. So again, we compare our analysis to the linear model. There is a large amount of overlap that could be quantified. But without making any assumptions about the data, we're able to find, just by unraveling, finding a new parameterization of the data set, where the interesting time series are, where the interesting voxels are. Okay, so I'll stop here. Thanks.